Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our podcast is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong's RegTech Lab, as well as the HKU Standard Chartered Foundation FinTech Academy, the Asia Global Institute, and the HKU edX Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from the university's Faculty of Law. India is in a strong growth mode compared to many of the world's largest economies right now. Since the mid to late 90s, the country has been known for its budding IT services sector, and it's no surprise, therefore, that in the three plus decades since the economy liberalized, that even more startups have risen up. Many have dreams of one day becoming publicly listed companies via the much-famed IPO route. Yet, being a developing nation, there are many opportunities but also myriad challenges that startups seeking to go public in India face. And that shall be the topic of our discussion with today's guest. As the head of the capital markets division of the renowned Indian law firm Jay Sagar Associates, New Delhi-based Madhurima Mukherjee has over two decades of experience in securities offerings in the domestic and international markets, including IPOs, further offers, rights offers, and qualified institutional placements and block trades. Some have referred to her as the queen of capital markets, as she has been part of some of the most high-profile capital raising efforts in the country, including the Coal India initial public offering in 2010. Which eventually raised the equivalent of $2.5 billion and remains one of India's largest IPOs. Prior to joining JSA, Madhu was a senior partner at AZB & Partners until April 2020. She's also worked with Lutheran Lutheran as a national head and partner until 2013, and prior to that was a partner at Amarchand Mangaldash and Suresh Roth & Company as a partner until 2006. Madhu is also a visiting professor and mentor at the West Bengal National University of Juridical Sciences and National Law School in New Delhi. Madhu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ajit.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Your educational background, where you grew up, and how you found your way into being a capital markets lawyer.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a checkered trajectory, I would say, especially given that I was a woman growing up in the 1990s in India, when corporate law itself was quite nascent. So I went to the National Law School of India University in Bangalore.
That's the Harvard Law of India, they said.
Yes. So it's famed to be, and it was a great institution. It was at its early stage when I went, but it was one of the first integrated campuses in the country for law as well as for BA degrees, the 5-year law program. And so I finished my program there, and I got hired into Amarchand Mangaldas, which was then the combined Amarchand Mangaldas, which has now been split into two other firms. It was interesting because I started my career in India at a time when, as I said, corporate law was just opening up. Liberalization had just come to the country. And it was, a lot of doing everything. A mixed bag of M&A, corporate law, banking and finance. I think we pretty much did everything that came our way. And okay. I was lucky enough to be in those days in one of the largest law firms in the country. And that sort of gave us a lot of early exposure to post-liberalization, foreign investment, as well as venture capital funds coming into the country for the first time. And startups for the first time, we didn't even know what a startup really meant. And it was only when we worked with the early venture caps like ChrisCap and Blackstone and guys like that, that we really realized, what it's like to start something up and invest money in early stage companies. And going to market was very alien to Indian companies those days. But yeah, the Securities and Exchange Board of India was formed. And that's when those early stage companies within the first 10 years of their life started to want to go to market. And again, I was lucky enough to be at the right place at the right time.
I was just thinking, when you started off, you said that you took basically all the work that came your way, all the different things that could come under the umbrella of financial services, whereas now I think we would agree financial services law in itself has become very specialized. And even in the securities realm, that too has become specialized. Have you noticed that specialization of the profession in India?
So yes, we have over the last two decades become super specialized. So as I said, we would do everything that came our way. Whatever came to the firm, we had a small team. We had a small team of specialized corporate lawyers. And we worked a lot with American law firms as well as UK law firms those days. And I still remember when we did the early GDR issuances or EDR issuances, which are global depository receipts for government companies those days, because those were the behemoths of the country raising capital in the US. I still remember American lawyers would come down to India and all the drafting documents would be faxed to us. So imagine a 500-page document coming in fax and we would have to mark it up by hand and fax it all back. So obviously, it was very early stage and everyone did everything. But as soon as SEBI was formed, we saw real early stage sort of growth of the Indian markets. And obviously, we had sophisticated clients of investment bankers as well as, other international lawyers that we worked with. And India was the mecca, right? It was the destination to go to. As the world was getting more and more saturated and the BRIC countries were becoming the safe haven for money, a lot of our investment banker friends as well as our private equity friends who had invested money in the country, they sort of started to look at Indian capital markets quite seriously, both in terms of debt as well as equity. And therefore, in many ways, we shaped laws. We had the new disclosure and investment protection guidelines. Then were a different guideline. And we used to call it the DIP guidelines those days. And that got recalled as SEBI started to become more and more sophisticated. And we started to grow with the market. And we started to learn from global best practices. I worked with Singapore law firms and learned how to do InvITs and REITs from them. We've worked with, US law firms and learned how to write offer documents and what were the best disclosure norms. We worked with UK law firms and worked with AIM listings and understood what different markets can do for you in terms of the sophistication of the market, main board versus a listing board which you could go and get quick and easy money from. So, in many ways, India has benefited and we've benefited with India because we were very well positioned to take advantage of early stage growth of India, as well as, growing up with the market and shaping a lot of the best practices that we see in the Indian market today. So, yes, in many ways, we started off doing everything, but today we are hyper-specialized, and I am a specialized capital. While I do a lot more things, but yes, I am a specialized capital markets lawyer for debt and equity today.
It certainly seems as though that opening up the economy definitely benefited the legal services field because the interaction with foreign firms, becoming, learning about international best practices and using that as a learning opportunity to raise the bar, raise the standard, raise what was expected in the local profession, benefited every, I mean, and let's be honest, India is such a huge country. There are so many different tiers and so many different price points for legal services. So I don't want to generalize, but if we're talking about a top tier firm, like even a top tier firm like Jay Sagar benefited from you know, interactions with foreign firms and the learning that took place, and they say never waste an opportunity to learn and to leverage that learning to better serve the next client.
100%. I mean, there is, I think, beyond reasonable doubt, the fact that we grew up in the late 90s and the early 2000s in India did benefit us. And some of those learnings we have today passed on to the younger members of our team. And every year we get a fresh crop, and everyone who gets fresh off the boat, we do try to pass on those learnings that we in turn learned from the global best practices. And today, India itself, I think we have many advantages to growing up in basically the early 2000s. India as a country was growing then. We're still growing, but at that stage, we just opened up to the rest of the world. And we were best positioned to service everyone who was coming from the US or the UK or the Asian markets. You know, we, in many ways, a lot of our associates as well as our partners in those days had foreign education. So, you know, we spoke the language, the global language. So it became easier for us to sort of blend in, understand global practices, visit these jurisdictions, work with these people. I still remember, you know, doing the Vedanta listing, which is now such a large conglomerate in India. And I was, you know, lucky enough that was one of my first capital markets transaction. And I went to London and I was there for a few weeks and I was working with Linklaters. And honestly, that in itself was such great training. And to just see how they conduct themselves so much beyond just the letter of the law, right? Which I already knew as an Indian lawyer. But it wasn't so much, you know, the Indian law in itself, but it was also, you know, how you conduct yourself in a meeting. What is really a drafting session? How do you, you know, draft a document? What is the best disclosure to put? How to, you know, deal with investment bankers, really understand their apprehensions, their requirements, what is it that, you know, the global best practices again in the finance sector is, you know, what could really go wrong and in a capital markets transaction. And that was what the great learning was. And the same goes for doing InBits in Singapore, for example, or doing debt documents in Hong Kong. I think we've learned a lot from just associating with global law firms and investment banks. And those learnings, in turn, we brought back into the country. And we have implemented those in our laws, in the way we write offer documents today in India. And the level of disclosure and scrutiny that you know, the regulator itself goes into. It's something that it's been a learning for the regulator itself, as well as for us. But as I said, we've all grown up together.
Then we turn to the challenges of associated with startups going public in India. And obviously, you know, there's the obvious ones of legal and regulatory hurdles, financial constraints, managerial issues. What, I mean, but those are just the ones I could envisage. I may be off the mark, but what do you see as the challenges of associated with startups going public?
So, Ajay, the most important thing to understand is capital markets or any public markets across the globe is sentiment driven. So, 2020 and 2021 was, we had a boom across the world in spite of the pandemic. And the excitement sort of trickled down to India as well. And like you very correctly said, so much of India is IT driven and internet-based companies, so many entrepreneurs, right, in the country. So for the first time, we saw our internet-based companies had grown up and they were ready for the market. And the regulator, the SEBI, worked quite hard with investment bankers and lawyers to sort of find unique solutions around some of these companies going to market. So typically these companies would lack a history or, some of them lack profitability. There were challenges around some of their fundamentals. But the regulator and investment bankers and lawyers were quite keen to see these companies succeed in the capital market. So, famously, Zomato, Paytm, Nykaa, all these big companies, which were startups, internet-based startups, went to market and did pretty well. And but the problem that became was investor confidence, because very quickly there was a huge slump in share prices. In 2022, if you see the trajectory of some of these companies, these companies had a pretty muted debut, to be honest. And over 60 to 70% of their initial IPO value or their market cap was eroded. So it lost a lot of market sentiment. As I said at the beginning of this, a lot of this has to do with market sentiment. And everyone, including private equity investors, the regulator, the investor sentiment sort of turned towards profitability. What are the fundamentals of these companies? Are they really doing well? Is it a lot of fluff, or is there something really core in each one of these startups that were worth investing in? So the first thing that I think startups faced as a challenge, or have faced as a challenge in the recent past, is definitely market sentiment, which turned against it, because the early inroads into the startup world of going public didn't go really well. The second thing is that, elections is always a big political event in India. And when elections come, or the politics of the country is not always stable, I think there is a little bit of nervousness around listing younger companies, companies you don't really understand very well, because obviously everyone's taking a punt on it, right? And it could go really well for you when you could make a huge amount of money, or it could really nosedive. So when you come to the public markets, while you qualified institutional guys may still have some appetite for it, but the public, which is the retail investors, really get nervous. So with our general elections, as you know, Ajay, is down around the corner. There is a little bit of wait and watch, and really trying to understand how those things go in the country. And if the current regime comes back, then there are signs. There are the political gurus who are saying, and the sort of market gurus who are saying that obviously the startup companies will start coming back to market, but that has been a challenge in the recent past. I think, it would be wrong of me not to touch upon valuations, which again sort of leads us back to why the early companies have eroded shareholder value. I think there was a lot of sort of misunderstanding about valuations of these companies. And these companies always have, some of these large ones especially, they're very private equity driven, financial investor driven, right? And these guys really like to extract value, and rightfully so. Why not? That's the reason they're there, and that's the reason they've come in early. And that in itself, unfortunately, hasn't worked out in the Indian market, because the first phase, or the first group of people who went to market, like I mentioned, Nykaa, Zomato, now famously the Paytm situation, you know, people have lost money in those companies, and not small change. They've lost big money. And because they've lost big money, there is now SEBI wants to really get into valuation in a deeper dive, which it's never done before. You know, earlier, bankers would want to go and discuss valuation. They would present something and SEBI was okay with it. Now I've heard from investment bankers, and obviously SEBI in many ways have changed the law. They've sort of, you know, brought about new requirements. They want a very detailed understanding of what the valuation of particular companies are going to be, or what are you raising this money and what are you going to do with this money going forward? Because SEBI's mandate in this country is to protect the capital markets and to protect the interests of the minority shareholders. And therefore, you know, that has again become a little bit of a challenge for startups, because they don't really, sort of, some of these valuations are obviously a little bit up in the air, a little bit sentiment driven, a little bit gut feeling, right? Rather than fundamentals, or a little bit based on where they're going rather than where they are right now. So that in itself has been a little bit of a challenge. You know, last but not the least, also, you know, there's no small market in India. We do have SME listings or small or medium company listings. But, you know, India doesn't have a dedicated stock exchange for startups like you would have the NASDAQ in India, in the US, or the Star Market in China. The Bombay Stock Exchange, as well as the National Stock Exchange, which are the most, you know, sort of popular places to list companies, they have pretty stringent norms and pretty sort of high level requirements. And, you know, honestly speaking, Ajay, it is expensive to list a company in those exchanges, deal with SEBI, pay the bankers, pay the lawyers, and get it right. So if you don't have that kind of money, and you want to just list it very quickly in a cheap way, in a smaller market or an easier market with sophisticated investors, India unfortunately doesn't have that yet. So you know, these are some of the challenges that startups do face in India in going to the public market.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned SEBI, because during my recent trip to Bombay, and people outside of India have echoed the sentiment too, there's a feeling that, broadly speaking, SEBI's been a good regulator, but in recent times they've been overactive. They've been overzealous. What are your thoughts?
So, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's a very tricky balance, right, that SEBI strikes.
It's, because they would say it's case by case.
Yes.
But then people feel they're detecting a trend.
So, you know, it's also a question of what has happened in the recent past. I would say it's a little bit of both trying to look over everyone's shoulder to ensure that things get done right. Because, Ajay, you have to understand that in a country like India, if things go bad with 10 companies, you know, the market is going to be written off. And, you know, suddenly, as I said, capital markets being so sentiment driven, it's suddenly going to be the, oh my God, you've got to watch your back if you're a foreign investor in India. You know, they are not a jurisdiction which is very tight. You know, Indian companies are big frauds. you know, they take people's money and vanish. And that's what happened in the 1990s, in the early 90s. A lot of foreign investors rushed to India as the new Mecca, as I said. And people lost a lot of money. The Harshad Mehta scams happened. A lot of vanishing companies happened. So, you know, you would put in money and then you would sort of sit back and, you know, a year later, you would realize that your money is gone. So SEBI actually cannot afford that. So in terms of their mandate, they are, as I said, they have to regulate the Indian capital markets. And they are a very, very strict regulator. There's no doubt about it. They are very zealous in what they do. And they do police. They do police. They do hold up the investment bankers. They do come and do inspections post-issue to understand what level of due diligence has been done. And I think that is not a bad thing. That is not a bad thing for the country. That is not a bad thing for the capital markets in itself, because I would much rather be safe than sorry when it comes to public money and when it comes to reaching out to the market for our market reputation, for the country to be you know, a safe haven for foreign investors to put in their money and understand that there is a rule of law and they will get their money back. So that's never a bad thing. But having said that, you're absolutely right. There is a little bit of a sentiment on the street that on certain things, flexibility is sort of little more difficult. There is less elbow room to maneuver. And, you know, there is less interest in funky structuring, I would say. At the lack of a better expression, you know, maverickish structures which don't really hold up the scrutiny. So I think it's very important for a country like ours, which is growing, to strike the right balance between regulation and norms and people feeling confident to put in their money in this country, versus being easy to maneuver, easy to sort of be nimble. Nimble is the word I was looking for. And really not turning off people who would otherwise come up with newer structures, would want to, you know, tap markets in a certain way, and really understanding the constraints that some companies genuinely feel. I think it's also to not judge SEBI so harshly. I would like to say that, you know, in the beginning of 2020, they were trying. They were really trying to understand startups, understand new age companies, understand internet-based companies. But unfortunately for all of us, things didn't go well. And there was an erosion of shareholder value. And that sort of set the whole industry as well as the regulatory mindset back. So yeah, it's been a mixed bag, actually.
Let's turn to the issue of valuation, which you mentioned. It's often said the value of something is really whatever the market will bear, whatever someone's willing to pay you for. But increasingly, there's a field of literature that says these valuation models that consultants and accountants come up with all are faulty in their own way, and valuation is more art than science. Therefore, yeah, there is potential for fraud. There is potential for chicanery. What are your thoughts on the efficacy and soundness of valuation models in this space?
So, you know, SEBI did come up with some proposals around valuations. As you said, you know, the investment bankers don't want very strict norms around valuation, right? Because if you really pin it down to black and white, it does not sort of serve every situation. And there are all sorts of companies, right? We have, a week ago, I listed a hospitality company which has run hotels in this country for the last 30 years. Whereas, you know, we're working with many manufacturing companies, brick and mortar, and we worked on with companies such as Yatra and internet-based companies who have a completely new age approach to doing business, and their businesses are very different. So the thing is that it's very hard to sort of pin down valuation norms in black or white. Having said that, you know, the SEBI has come up with, and you know, requirements around the basis of issue price, you know, such as, you know, earnings per share, price to earnings, return on net worth, net asset value of companies, as well as a comparison between accounting ratios with peers, you know, and the SEBI has tried to sort of put some metrics around this, you know, which, like for new age companies, they've said, you know, we want to understand your KPIs or your key performance indicators. We want to understand, you know, they've come up with a consultation paper on basis of issue price, etc., etc. So, you know, they have tried to put some fetters around it. But as I said, and you said yourself, you know, you're in Mumbai and a lot of people are saying, you know, SEBI's become overzealous and they don't understand the landscape. They're policing too much. But at the same time, you know, there is erosion of shareholder value because of, you know, too much of, you know, of becoming a little too greedy in terms of valuation, etc. So it's a fine balance. SEBI is trying to strike that balance between the brick and mortar companies as well as the startups, as well as, you know, companies who have not made profits yet, versus understanding, you know, what could be the future of these companies, how do we map that, how do we understand business, you know, etc., etc. So, you know, SEBI is trying. And they have put in some norms around it. They do want to engage with the bankers closer than they ever have. But at the end of this day, you know, valuation is so much not only about financial metrics as well as the, you know, performance indicators, as well as understanding the business, which I'm sure sophisticated investors do. But for the layperson on the road, it's more a question of who's anchoring this deal. Who were the private equity who had put money into this? Who are the people who are going to be the anchor investors? Do we really understand the space? And chances are we don't. So, you know, just go with the gut valuation and who your merchant bankers are. Who are your investment bankers? Are they big investment bankers, reputable investment bankers in this country? Are they good lawyers on the deal who also shape opinion these days in the country? So, you know, those are some of the things that I think would be more of a gut feeling. Valuation still remains, you know, a subjective matter. And it's something that if I had to advise investors to invest in startups, I would go with not only the fact that you please look at key performance indicators, look at the financial matrix, look at the basis of issue price, which is very well disclosed in an offer document, but also go with the merchant bankers and the lawyers and the private equity, as well as the anchor investors in a particular deal, and then only invest in a particular company, because honestly, it's very hard for valuation to be pinned down into a little box.
I acknowledge that, that we have to look at that enforcement activity in light of the fact that consumer protection is also a key goal and part of the regulator's mandate, investor protection, and also the huge variance in financial sophistication. And if you want to instill faith in the capital markets, but that's perhaps a policy conversation that's maybe beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. But come back to the startups. Really, since the dot-com bubble and the crash 2 decades ago, when most people hear the term startup, they're conditioned to nowadays think of tech startups, because that's where a lot of young people have been able to make money real quickly. Are most of your clients in the startup space tech startups or not?
Yeah, I think mostly they are internet-based. And of course, you do have companies like Byju's who have brick and mortar. You know, Nykaa has started brick and mortar at the point that they started off as an internet-based company and tech startup, but obviously eventually they have moved towards brick and mortar. Mama Earth is the same thing. Now they have outlets everywhere. But yeah, mostly internet-based startups is, I think, startups in India have, you know, at least in the recent past, gone to market. But yes, there is, you know, electric cars are something that's gaining a lot of importance right now. Ola Electric tried to list itself. There are a few lined up. Renewables are another sort of area where startups have done pretty a lot of business. A lot of them haven't really ended up getting listed again because of confusions on valuation and lack of profitability. But yeah, I think if I would divide up the pie, I would say 75% to 80% would be tech startups.
That's a large segment. So what advice would you give to startups, tech and otherwise, that wish to tap the capital markets in future?
So I think, my experience with startups is that obviously because they're young, they're sometimes their founders themselves are very young and they lack initial capital. I think they sort of don't take internal corporate governance as well as, getting their books in order early stage. And that, I think, is, Ajay, a very, very big mistake. Because if I were to advise, startups today, and some of our partners do advise startups, we do internal brainstorming where we do tell them that if the final goal is to go to market, which 90% of the time it is, whether they get early stage venture capital or private equity or any other sort of capital, or even if it's the founder's own capital, eventually the dream is to list, right? And to go to market, grow up and go to market. I would say start young with getting your books in order, getting your corporate governance in place. So it is very, very important that you get a good board of directors with good advisors on it. And that in itself would be testament, right, to your good track record and all the ones that have actually done well, like Delivery and a couple of others who've, I'm not talking about well in the stock market or that has been a little dodgy going up and down, but those are the big valuation, big sort of, you know, interesting startups. Those have all had very good early stage board of directors, early stage, overseeing of their corporate governance. They've also had private equity come in and sort of, first taken small capital from good private equity if you can attract those names. If you can't, you still get your books in order. I think get a good auditor, because the biggest problem today with startups or any company wanting to go to market is to clean up your books and your capital structure, because, you know, it's done in a very haphazard way. Friends and family put in money into startups sometimes. The sort of filing of documents in the registrar of companies is not done. Everything is done in a very, very unsophisticated and haphazard manner. And I would say that's a rookie mistake. Because if your ultimate goal is to become blue chip and to go to market, get your corporate governance in place, get a decent board of directors, clean up your books, ensure that they're good from the start. Because look at the situation that Byju's is facing today. What a large and prestigious name in the startup industry. And today it is in so much trouble because of its internal governance issues. Look at what has happened with so many of the companies that Sequoia dealt with. And Sequoia is now rolled back and sort of, you know, restructured because so many of them had internal corporate governance issues. So, you know, let that sort of, you know, really pushes you back. And maybe some of it is not deliberate. Some of it is young people not really understanding what is corporate governance, what is, you know, what is good auditors. Some of it is just, you know, young companies or even companies, you know, the whole Indian mentality of, you know, let's not spend money on getting expensive lawyers or bankers or a company secretary for that matter, or someone or good auditors at the start, because why waste money? I think that would be very foolish for companies who want to hit the market. You must have good corporate governance, good capital structure, you know, keep an eye out for good lawyers who are advising you from the start, you know, giving you good advice in the contracts that you enter into, the sort of arrangements that you enter into, even the private equity that you take. I think you should get good advice on who to go to, who not to go to, you know, and make sure that you get blue chip investors into yourself, and then, you know, grow in a very structured manner. So that when you go to market, these things become moot, because SEBI is going to look at you and SEBI is going to look at you with a tooth comb. And it starts from the day you start the company and not the day you want to file with SEBI to take the company to market. So I would say don't make rookie mistakes, you know, start from the very beginning.
Your point about maintaining good books and records and sound governance is salient, because I was a consultant at a university once, and we helped small technology oriented startups, and I very quickly saw how many of them let their bookkeeping fall to the wayside, maintaining good accounts, and the feeling was, well, we're not at that stage yet. Do we really need it? We're a startup. The feeling that you wouldn't be held to those standards. But then, you know, we had to advise them. But if you want serious investors to take you, you know, those with means to take you seriously, then you've got up your game. You've got up your standards. But that's a valid point. So as we look at India's economy growing while those around it are struggling, the stock market recently overtook Hong Kong's in size, and people here are still reeling from that. They're trying to figure out what went wrong on our side. Yet the startup scene in Mumbai and Bangalore is still very competitive, and young companies in those cities recently told me liquidity is an issue, and they wish India was as liquidity rich as the US or Europe. Any thoughts about that? And are any of the startups that you've taken public, have they voiced any aspirations of going overseas at some point to list as well?
So I think, as I said, in the capital markets, everything is so, I keep saying this, but it's so true. It's so sentiment driven, right? So in terms of startups, I think it's an unfair thing to say that India doesn't have liquidity. India itself doesn't have liquidity, but Indian startups for years of, for decades actually have got a lot of money from US investors as well as global investors and very, very reputed investors, right? Who have come in from small venture funds to, large private equity and financial investors such as Blackstone and Warburg and Sequoia and et cetera, et cetera. The list could keep going on. But we've had private equity for decades in this country, honestly.
So the ones that are struggling with liquidity, then what's their problem?
I think what they re really need to understand is that you have to really create investor confidence. You have to have your fundamentals in place. The unfortunate truth of the matter is that in 2020, if you were a startup and you wanted to sort of, list every sort of guy with a little bit of a checkbook would come down your door and hammer it down to buy into your company, right? And that we're talking 4 years ago or 5 years ago. But today, the unfortunate truth of the matter is that even the mammoth companies such as the ones I mentioned, like Paytm and Baidu and Nykaa and everyone else, Zomato, all the guys who picked up big money from a lot of people, right, didn't necessarily keep their promises. So therefore, there is a downward sentiment in money. And people are very cautious right now. So it'll again, Ajit, turn, provided the next few do really well. Like Mamaearth, for example, it didn't list very well, but it gained momentum and it got oversubscribed in the end. And they have, I think, posted a profit. I haven't tracked the story very closely lately, but they have posted a profit. RateGain did really well, for example. Traxen did pretty well. So these are some of the companies that we had taken to market, which we know, Traxen, RateGain. They've come back and done sort of, RateGain has done a QIP as well, which is a qualified institutional placement. So there is interest. People want to keep going back and putting money into the same company over and over again. But you've got to get your fundamentals right. So profitability is a struggle, but you have to at least have a roadmap. So I think from the little bit of disappointment is definitely from the overvalued stocks, such as Paytm and Zomato, which were once hailed as the messiahs of the tech, the tech space and the startup space, but they haven't really, sort of gone well. The second thing is that there is a market saturation and there is a lot of competition. So maybe if you were a startup 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it was a new space. People didn't understand it so well. The private equities and the financial investors and even the angel investors are very hungry. They put in money in anything with a little bit of a business plan and smart founders. They were very keen to sort of put in money. But because things have gone sour and there is so much, like every kid who's coming out of any business school or law school today wants to do a startup. Okay, that is in fashion, Ajay. You have to agree with me on that. And there is so much, like today, if you had one Indian restaurant in Hong Kong, everyone would be going to that Indian restaurant, however good or bad that was. But if you suddenly have a bevy of 50 Indian restaurants in Hong Kong, you really have to take the pick of the litter. So there is a lot of market saturation in India right now when it comes to the startup space. I think also regulatory uncertainties with SEBI as well as the environment around the elections, make it even a little more sort of wait and watch. Please understand what the government is going to do. You know, because political stability in a country like India is very, why only India? I mean, all around the world is very, very important. And I do think the Ukraine war or what is happening in Gaza right now has done any favors to the capital markets. So everyone's nervous, everyone is waiting and watching. So that, you know, free capital, that easy money has really dried up. And that's the reason probably some of your friends in the startup space are feeling some of the pain.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Indian restaurants in Hong Kong. Very expensive being Indian in Hong Kong, so much so that I know many people that say, I'd rather just wait until I'm in Dubai or India to have real Indian food because so many of the restaurants here are overrated and overpriced.
Maybe that's a new startup idea, Ajay. For you and me to open our new Indian restaurant in Hong Kong.
And they're serving Chinese and Western palates. So if they're content with it, so be it. But I'm saying it's like, it really has to do with the core. How many Indians do you have in that society? Like Dubai, as my late mother would call it. It's a polished India. So you have Indian food at many price points. So it's a lot more affordable. Same with Singapore. Less so with Hong Kong. I don't know. They seem to think all the Indians here are rich. And in terms of people that have invested in India and gotten burned, to come back to something you said earlier, well-known family, the Haralelas, the family of Indian Sindhi billionaires here, they've had prior ventures in India. They've gotten burned. They're staring clear of it. They say, okay, we're an Indian family, but we're a Hong Kong family first and foremost. We wish India well. But our fortunes are tied with the success of this city, so their focus is Hong Kong. And amongst the things, the Haralelas, amongst others, have complained, and even the people in Bombay that I recently spoke to have said, were things like the challenges of getting and retaining talent, the government support of the lack thereof, in terms of red tape and taxation and. You know, the lack of support programs, that there are countries that actively want to nurture and provide incubators, which is what I was doing once in Chicago as a consultant early in my career, that provide that nurturing incubation space for startups. And that they're saying that that's lacking in India, other than on certain university campuses, perhaps. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, so India's never been easy, right? India is complex, it's layered, it has many, unlike Hong Kong or Singapore, which is, and Hong Kong before obviously China and post China, India is complex, and while we do have a very strong rule of law. When it comes to the financial markets, for sure. I mean, I don't want to argue on other aspects, but yes, it has a very strong rule of law when it comes to the capital markets. It can be tough. It can be tough for someone who is an outsider to come in and sort of impose. It's not easy to impose on India. It's not easy to come in here, start a restaurant business and do what you did in China or Dubai or Singapore or America for that matter. And say, this is the way we do things and this is the way it will be. But I will give you McDonald's, example, which has thrived and worked around the world, including in India. When McDonald's first came in, Ajay, I don't know if you've ever tracked the story, but people burnt down McDonald's outlets, saying that these companies are American companies, they sell beef, that they are
really?
Against our... Yes. All I was trying to say about McDonald's was that McDonald's adapted. They changed the menu, yep. And Indians are adaptable. So if you have I wouldn't say that we get shortchanged because we are Hindu. I just say that Hinduism is about adaptability. Hinduism is not even a religion. Hinduism is a way of life.
Correct.
And a way of life, we are probably the only religion which does not convert people. You know, the Vedas don't talk about conversion. They talk about a way of life. And if you followed that way of life, you were a Hindu. So
there are even atheists that could call themselves Hindus. So, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Therefore, I would say India is a lot like that. You know, you've got to come in. I do not support autocratic regimes anywhere in the world. I do believe that the country is an open country. Our constitution gives you some basic rights and fundamental rights and liberties. And you have to, you know, come. But we are a complex country. So you have to adapt. You have to adapt anywhere in the world, but you particularly need to understand India. So we have, obviously, Ajay, the English-speaking folk, the people like you and me who speak the same language, but we also have, you know, a person down the road who might be your target customer, or, you know, who might be buying a mobile phone, or who might be, you know, ordering an Uber or food on Zomato, but doesn't speak a word of English, you know, who does not come from a very sort of global background, but is wealthy. And you might, that person in India might be your target audience. So for you to really understand, and the governments can be complex. Again, governments around the world can be complex, but the governments in India obviously are famously known for their corruption, but the point I would like to make to anybody who would like to come into India to invest or be a startup is that the corruption is not at a petty level. Do you get what I'm saying? It won't be. It's like in New Delhi or in Mumbai today, your pocket will not be picked anymore because it's not about small money. Okay, there might be a major corruption. That's a different issue. But when we are talking about startups, yes, they will struggle to get their licenses in place. They will struggle with a certain level of corruption at an operation level. You will need to learn how to adapt to the Indian markets and turn the profitability around. But once you do, your investors, your SEBI, your regulators, they are going to be supported, and there is a rule of law in the country. That's what I would end with.
I appreciate what you're saying, that the corruption is not at street level anymore than the old days, but that which you were entitled to as a citizen, you had to pay a bribe for. That, you know, before I accept your payment at, say, a government office, I want payment to accept your payment. That sort of nonsense still goes on.
And
in certain African countries.
Ajay, I would not say, I think I would be overstating the case if I say that it does not go on in the real estate area. You know, if you were to buy a house, or, you know, if you were to buy an office, or, you know, you didn't have to deal with the labor commissioners, or you didn't have to deal with, you know, that kind of thing happens. However, having said that, you know, it won't be rampant. It won't be today. If you wanted to come into a major city and hire office space, you don't need to bribe anyone, because there's enough of private real estate companies who are leasing out space without any bribes being paid to anybody. You don't need to do that. So that is the value add, I would believe. You know, if you today wanted to get a passport in this country, you don't have to necessarily bribe anyone to do it. So those cleanups have happened. But yes, of course, there are wheels within wheels. And I suppose everyone knows that about India. You would be naive if you wanted to do business here and didn't know that about India.
It does take longer to change the norms and mores of a country of a billion people. But one last thing about the securities regulation. Is there... If we come at it from a startup perspective, is there anything that can be done to improve the securities and listing rules to make it easier for startups to go public in India?
I think SEBI was trying, as I said, a couple of years ago to understand new age companies better, to have different norms.
Secondary boards. Yeah.
Yeah. And last but not the least, as I said, you know, we do need a younger secondary board, like not the main board, which is very high, very strict, very time consuming and costly, right? It's expensive to list yourself in the main board. But yeah, a secondary market for, they did try for the SME listings to have a different sort of platform. Some of it is, you know, has taken off, but not at the level that we would ideally like it to be. So yes, the dream would be to have a very robust sort of secondary market, which would support startups.
Okay. And lastly, for those students contemplating creating their own startups, or those that those young lawyers that can see themselves one day serving such startups, what guidance would you give them? Other than, I mean, how do they come to better understand the startup space?
I would say, if I had one word, you know, if you ask me, Malima, what would be your favorite word for a startup? I would say corporate governance.
Okay.
You know, two words, corporate governance. Please do not underestimate, as I said, corporate governance. It's very important right now. You might be excited about your business. You have an idea. That idea is taking shape. People are getting interested. You're building your model. You're building your process. Please, please invest in good lawyers. Good, startup lawyers. There are enough of them in India who are not that expensive, us included. You know, we do understand how startup spaces work. You know, we also do understand how to grow with the business, but good corporate governance, invest in good lawyers, good auditors, you know, clean up your books, ensure that you get good talent. I think you have to ensure that you keep your head above the water when it comes to actually growing in a very structured way.
Well put. In the limited time we've got left, those were all the questions I had for you, but I want to be respectful of your time. Was there anything you wanted to say before we finish up, or anything you feel we didn't cover?
Achidi, Ajay, your questions have been quite comprehensive, but we're still very excited in India for the startup space. You know, lot of really interesting companies, lot of really interesting space, as I said, electric cars, renewables, you know, a lot of people coming up with a lot of fun ideas and very dynamic. So excited to remain in the space, excited to advise young companies who are looking to go to market. It's good to be plugged into the space. So whoever's listening in, do sign up for the... That's the other thing I would tell startups, you know, create your own village. It really does take a village to go to market. So create your own village, you know, stay in touch with good lawyers, good people like yourselves, Ajay. You know, create your own network. And that really helps when it comes down to it.
No, I agree. In fact, some of the social mixes I went to, as you said, very, a lot of energy, a lot of creativity, a lot of dynamism. But I hadn't encountered that, say, maybe 10 years ago. But yeah, and then there were so many events, so many mixers, more than I could go attend to in a given week. There was multiple events going on every night. And it just underscores the importance of relationships, as you were saying, in terms of it takes a village, and your social capital, your goodwill within that village is based on relationships, and that'll determine how far you go. Madhu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ajay. Thank you for having me.
And to our listeners, until next time.